Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for October 7th, 2009. I'm your host, Command Line, the self-proclaimed hacker, curmudgeon, and hacktivist, and this is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing from over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of society and politics with technology, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a feature cast. In it, I have a new inner chapter on the subject of personal advocacy. I have a new hacker word of the week, and I have some listener feedback that I'll address. First, though, I wanted to take this opportunity to ask you to strongly consider joining in the Creative Commons 5th Annual Fundraising Campaign. They just announced this. If you've donated in the past or otherwise gotten onto their mailing list, you probably got a great letter from the current CEO, Joey Ito, asking you to think about contributing. They have a variety of ways that you can do this. I myself am a sustaining donor. That means that I give them a small amount every month on a continuous basis. And I urge you, if you're in a position where you can consider doing that, that you do that. Because for a small not-for-profit like the Creative Commons is, it's a lot easier for them to budget and rely on even small continuous donations rather than once a year or once a lifetime larger donations. If you do make a larger donation, though, they have a unique prize this time out. This is a t-shirt, which is not uncommon, actually, for a lot of these kinds of online-focused not-for-profits. The EFF has a new t-shirt every year around the same time, around their fundraising coordination. But the shirt this year is a remix of the Creative Commons kind of logo and aesthetic from Shepard Fairey, of all people. And it's a very attractive shirt. It's worth taking a look at that. They have a very nice shot of that well modeled up on the entry on their weblog, which I'll link to in the show notes. The Creative Commons really is critical, not just for the licensing work that they do. If you've just recently listened to the recording of the copyright panel from DragonCon this year, Courtney Lytle, the token lawyer on the panel, was very complimentary of the strength of writing that went into the license itself. They put a lot of technology that we also discuss on that panel behind that in terms of machine-readable forms, machine-parsable forms of those licenses. But they also work on a lot of communication, outreach, and tooling. If you've used the Internet Archive at all, that site utilizes one of the many technology projects that the Creative Commons supports. That is a web service for interacting with a license choice mechanism, and it's used by any number of other sites besides. They have other libraries directly to be embedded in applications to really further and make it easier for people to support and utilize these licenses. They also do a really good job, I think, of in their just their ongoing communications campaigns to draw attention to some of the most innovative, imaginative, and interesting creators out there contributing to the Open Commons by using the Creative Commons licenses. So just take a few minutes, check the link out, and see if you don't agree that the Creative Commons is definitely a cause worthy of consideration for your charitable giving for the year. Listener feedback this week is in form of a question sent to me from recent listener Eric, who writes, "While listening to your podcast containing your speech on Software Freedom Day, by the way, best quality non-studio recording thus far, you mentioned being an IP wonk. I was curious what you thought of the following issues I raised in this specific blog post." I'll include the link to said blog post, and I'll try to summarize that. Thanks for the feedback, Eric. Thanks especially for the compliment on the audio from my Software Freedom Day talk. What Eric draws attention to, just very briefly in his blog posting, is that the photos up on whitehouse.gov are all dedicated to the public domain, as are all of the photos taken, I guess, by the staff photographers of the White House. But there's a curious disclaimer about the use of certain images, that they're conditioned on, let me read this directly from Eric's post because he pulls it out quite well. The disclaimer reads, "This official White House photograph is being made available for publication by news organizations and/or for personal use printing by the subjects of the photograph. The photograph may not be manipulated in any way or used in materials, advertisements, products, or promotions that in any way suggest approval or endorsement of the president, the first family, or the White House." And Eric goes on to consider whether this is an odd sort of constraint on the public domain. The public domain really is binary. Once something is in the public domain, then there are no longer any conditions. That's the purpose of the public domain. And that, as far as it goes, is correct, Eric. And as I wrote back to him in my reply, because he sent this a while ago and I just hadn't had the chance to address this question on the show, is that while I'm not a lawyer, what really I think is going on here is it's more of an issue of right of publicity rather than copyright. As I said, the manipulation appears to be solely conditioned such that in any way suggests approval or endorsement of the president, the first family, or the White House. You basically cannot represent that they are saying something through these photos or your manipulations thereof that they have not explicitly said. That's not a copyright issue. That's an issue about putting words in their mouth. So it's not about limiting the remix that the public domain allows. And this issue is not just unique to the public domain. This is true of copyrighted works and works released under liberal licenses like the Creative Commons as well. Just because you give a grant around reproduction, manipulation, and the like, remix, doesn't mean that you can use that to make misrepresentations about the subjects of the photo. So these are, I understand the confusion, and I hope that my answer in some ways has helped to clarify this. I'm happy to spend some more time on this, Eric, if that doesn't address your question, or if somebody else has a further question to try to unpack these couple of issues here. If you yourself have a question or a thought that you'd like to share, as always, I welcome feedback, which can be sent to feedback@thecommandline.net. You can post that as a comment on the website, or you're welcome to call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. The hacker word of the week comes from the jargon file maintained by Eric Raymond at catb.org. Epoch, noun. Reader's note. I've also heard this pronounced epoch, but cannot find any substantiation of that as a correct pronunciation. Unix, probably from astronomical timekeeping. The time and date corresponding to zero in an operating system's clock and timestamp values. Under most Unix versions, the epoch is 00:00:00 GMT, January 1, 1970. Under VMS, it's 00:00:00 of November 17, 1858, base date of the U.S. Naval Observatory's ephemerides. On a Macintosh, it's the midnight beginning January 1, 1904. System time is measured in seconds or ticks past epoch. Weird problems may ensue when the clock wraps around, see wraparound, which is not necessarily a rare event. On systems counting 10 ticks per second, a signed 32-bit count of ticks is good only for 6.8 years. The 1-tick-per-second clock of Unix is good only until January 18, 2038, assuming at least some software continues to consider it signed and that word lengths don't increase by then. See also wall time. Microsoft Windows, on the other hand, has an epoch problem every 49.7 days. But this is seldom noticed as Windows is almost incapable of staying up continuously for that long. The inner chapters journal my own quest to improve in the craft of programming. Each chapter reflects on a specific practice or principle through the lens of my own experiences, both as a professional and an enthusiast. The name refers to the Chinese classic of philosophy, the Chuanzi. Divided into two sections, the inner chapters make up the first part, attributed to the philosopher Chuanzi himself. The commentaries on the first section, written by his students and others, are known as the outer chapters. I hope you will contribute to my outer chapters by sharing your own thoughts and experiences on growing as a programmer. A I've had the opportunity recently to consider this idea of personal advocacy. First of all, I wanted to start by considering the question, what is advocacy? It's defined as active supporter of an idea or a cause, especially the act of pleading or arguing for something, speaking on behalf of someone. There isn't, though, always someone to speak for you with the things that you need pursued. The idea, then, of personal advocacy is to be your own advocate where it's needed and appropriate. This, admittedly, can be difficult to accomplish and still adhere to a principle that I espouse here, that of humility. Usually, remaining humble as a personal advocate means just being open to opportunity and speaking honestly in those situations. Stick to facts, but don't be afraid to share ones that you think are relevant to the situation at hand. This is pretty much, I think, the flip side of knowing your limits, an aspect of humility that I've explored. That is, that feeling confidence in knowing what you know. Most of the time, I would say it's better to err on the side of assuming that you are, in fact, ignorant. If you are confident of what you do not know, though, you should actually be able to speak pretty well to those things that you actually do have an understanding of. That being said, I still think it's safest to speak about what you've accomplished when advocating. The implications about what you know should be clear and arise from that, rather than allowing any question of particular hair-splitting points of which you might be ignorant eroding your position as an advocate. Personal advocacy is clearly very different from general advocacy. That, I think, typically does actually require some extra effort around knowledge acquisition, reading and research and the like. The opportunities to support your view may differ, though, in that requirement. Advocating to management or teammates is going to require some form of following up. You can do the same for general advocacy, where there is an interest group, like a user group, but the form of that support, I think, is qualitatively different between these two forms of advocacy. You're contributing to institutional knowledge like wikis and mailing lists in the vein of supporting general advocacy, and the size of the audience that you're able to reach may differ as well. That might actually affect how you choose to communicate. In personal advocacy, I think that you're going to maybe find more value in using synchronous tools like face-to-face meetings, phone calls, things of that nature. But I think beyond that, beyond some of maybe the logistical differences, the principles that guide these two forms of advocacy are pretty consistent. One thing I will urge in the form of caution is to always remember the rule of selling, that is to stop when you've sold someone. Spending too many cycles on advocating for a cause that you've already convinced somebody of may actually damage your credibility. Know when you've successfully persuaded someone on a point, and conversely, also recognize a no-sale, that somebody that no amount of persuasion, no amount of advocating is going to convert to your cause, to your point of view. Sometimes, for any number of reasons, someone just can't be persuaded. If you push too hard, that advocacy can often have the opposite and hence undesirable effect. You need to demonstrate in those circumstances your sense of appropriateness, too. My recent job search at the end of last year, actually, it was one of the things that brought this topic very much to the front of mind. It really requires, when you are trying to find that next opportunity, that you be your own best representative. And what really got me going on this was a coding horror post where somebody was complaining about how their open source portfolio didn't help their job search at all. And I'll include a link to my response to that, that this is one place where being your own advocate is absolutely essential. A recruiter, if you're working with one of the better ones, may do some advocacy on your behalf. They will never know your strengths as well as you do, though. You need to recognize when to draw attention to your accomplishments specifically, accomplishments that speak well of your ability to fill a specific opportunity. You need to relate your strengths then through concrete experience. Explaining you are excellent at a particular skill or tool is simply not enough. On a related note, accomplishments on their own are also not enough. In a dense resume, or a rich online presence, they can get lost in just the sheer volume of information that's there. You need to show your understanding of what a job opening actually requires and relate your experiences directly to those requirements. This is the point that I think the gentleman who was lamenting the fact that his open source portfolio wasn't helping him. I think that's the point he completely missed here. You also don't have to stick to being merely technical. In my current job, a big part of the product under development are social networking tools. I was actually able in that hiring process, in that consideration, to speak about my experience as a podcaster and a blogger, somebody who uses these tools to produce the things that I put out every week. I let my employer know I was interested in what they were building as a creator using similar tools, that I possessed more than just the programming chops for the job. Without acting as my own interested, motivated advocate in that case, that would never have come up. The burden was wholly on me to see that this was an appropriate experience that spoke very specifically to a requirement in their space. Another situation that may require personal advocacy is arguing for an idea in a project. It might be a strong notion about a good design or some crucial experience on one implementation approach over another. This is actually very closely related to another subject that I've talked about, affecting change. I'll include a link to that inner chapter in the show notes as well. Advocacy is usually the first step, convincing decision makers to try something new. It is also a concrete way of demonstrating another principle that I've talked about, thought leadership. I'll include a link to that inner chapter in the show notes as well. It shows that you are taking the initiative, you're championing that new idea, doing what's required to communicate its benefits. I have actually done this repeatedly throughout my career. The first time was probably advocating for my employers to consider trying enterprise Java for the very first time. I had experienced the limits of scale in the technologies that we were using at that time and felt that the early EJB specification and implementations were a better design and a better system to address those inadequacies of scale in the current tools that we were using. I went out on my own initiative and learned as much as I could about the technology, enriched myself in it in order to be able to speak effectively about its advantages and also about trade-offs, any disadvantages that might come into the discussion as well. I educated my peers on these differences. I argued persuasively to convince them and management simply to give it a try in a pilot fashion. I ultimately ended up establishing a new practice at that consulting shop and worked with, in the form of following up and sustaining that advocacy, with Sun's training group, their educational folks, to support the people that I had successfully persuaded to that point of view. At the job after that, the business-to-business procurement vendor, I advocated for the first model viewer controller implementation. I participated in early research and development in the form of acquiring knowledge and becoming versed in the subjects that were needed. And again, spent a good deal of time on my own education first before turning around and sharing that acquired knowledge with the people I was trying to convince. I focused again on the problems with the past approach, with a monolithic UI code that had been written and where it fell down and where I felt this new approach would solve it better. I tried to understand Struts in particular was the framework that we were looking at, how it was a more appropriate solution for these sorts of issues, and helped in constructing a prototype system to concretely demonstrate those benefits. This was also partly to aid my own understanding, that of the my peer who was advocating with me. I was not undertaking this alone, but also as a communications and an education tool. I could concretely show off how much easier the new design was and also use it as a springboard. I helped to jointly develop some additional application-specific idioms on top of that, which would not have been possible with the monolithic design that we had in place before that. Helped then with early framework development to support, again, once I had made my case successfully, to support that view and help people realize that value. In that case, the willingness to mentor or support made advocacy far more effective than just arguing persuasively on its own. I did more than simply tell people they should use something different. I was one of the ones doing so first, demonstrating the benefit by doing, leaving a concrete and readable trail for others to follow. That early experience has very much shaped how I advocate for new ideas now. It has also helped me realize which ideas are worth championing. They had to be worth that effort to really understand and then to support others in their understanding and adoption of those ideas. There are cases where I felt a particular tool or design was just flat out better and thought better of the cost to actually advocate for that better alternative, especially when the difference in the long run in the grand scheme of things was smaller. So it's not just the personal conviction, but in my case, the pragmatism, that utility function to do a little bit of cost-benefit style thinking to make sure that the cost of advocating is actually worth the benefit of having persuaded people to adopt some new idea or approach. There are plenty of other opportunities for advocacy. As I said, thought leadership may depend on it. Mentoring at times, especially with peers, may require some advocacy to persuade people. I'm curious what, given the definitions that I've discussed and the examples that I provided, what you all think of in terms of other opportunities from your own experience or that you recognize out in the world to apply personal advocacy. So how best really to, at a practical detailed level, go about advocating for a personal opportunity? I would say start with being coherent and understandable. You cannot advocate in any circumstances if you cannot be understood. Organize your thoughts if you have to. Write them down. Just the exercise of making a bulleted list really can help crystallize your thinking. It shows maybe where you are leaving too much unsaid and you might have to explain a bit more, or when you are pulling together thoughts that seem, once voiced, contradictory. Use your full communication skills. Grab an early adopter or a willing peer. Draw out your ideas on a whiteboard. Don't just rely on prose or on speaking. Using all of these modalities will force you to think much more clearly by shifting amongst them, and also by thinking in front of an audience. If you fail to convince that one person, try to figure out why. What is wasted motion in your pitch? Anything that doesn't help convince them of your main point? Did they get hung up on something trivial? Were they stuck on some detail that maybe you need to de-emphasize or you need to streamline in some way? Did they fail to understand any of your points? Does it require more explanation, more examples? You may also be able to get a sense of what your costs are after succeeding based on that initial reaction from that first early adopter. Does your idea beg more complexity than you ultimately have time? Again, speaking to that pragmatic aspect, that weighing of benefits versus costs. Using anecdotes, examples, and metaphors is also, I think, critical. You have to provide a bridge from where someone's thoughts are now to the perspective that you want them to share. You have to relate the new idea you are advocating to what they already know. In a job interview, that's part of tailoring your advocacy to the opening that I spoke about earlier. On a project, pointing out the similarities to code designs and fixtures they already use can affect that bridge. The more concrete you can make these things, the easier it will be to convince them, especially if they can continue to work through your ideas even after you've finished the conversation. In the case of your portfolio of open source code, you need to light the beacon that leads them through your projects. Get them interested, make them understand why they would want to read specific sources, but then ultimately they then have that portfolio to dig through in more detail on their own once you've shown them the way. For a new idea or design on a project, instill motivation to understand. Give them a reason to read the material that you've suggested or to play with any prototype code or examples you provide. In all cases, if they come back with an interested question, you know you've hooked them. Follow up with more answers and you are well on your way to success and personal advocacy. These are just some of my thoughts and experiences on this idea of personal advocacy. You no doubt have your own, and I would very much welcome the opportunity to hear them and to share them with everybody else. Theme music is The Wicked Thoughts of You by Tafubar, remixed by Mo Shang for the album Asian Variations. For more information, visit AsianVariations.com. This music used under permissions of a Creative Commons music sharing license. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed the program, please go to the website at thecommandline.net, make a donation, purchase some swag, or at the very least, tell a friend. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback at thecommandline.net, or you can post a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. The next show, which should go out in the feed Sunday night, will be a news program as usual, so until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank Libsyn and WahaDB for media hosting and bandwidth. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits, and permissions to use those are granted under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike Version 3.0 United States License.